This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. What is strategic foresight? How can strategic foresight help government leaders be more effective? And what is the mission of the Center for Strategic Foresight at the Government Accountability Office, GAO? I'll explore these questions and so much more with my very special guest, Stephen Sanford, Director of GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight. Steve, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Steve, I'd like to provide some context and a little background for our listeners. What does the U.S. Government Accountability Office do?
Right, Michael. So we're actually an agency in the legislative branch of the federal government. And we support Congress directly in meeting its constitutional responsibilities to help improve performance and ensure oversight over the federal government. And so GAO is a unique entity. We provide nonpartisan, objective information and analysis to Congress regarding the performance of federal agencies. And we also make all of our work available to the public as well. So we're really the watchdog for the federal government, and we are there to support Congress in their oversight function.
That's an important context. So, Steve, would you tell us more about the history and mission of GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight? What prompted its creation? And more importantly, how does it support the overall mission of GAO?
Sure. Well, you know, foresight has been part of GAO's DNA for decades. It's not a new concept for GAO. If you go back and look at some of our previous strategic plans going back years, you'll see there's always an element of trend analysis and it's kind of situating the agency and the nation in a strategic context, a kind of a broader strategic context. That said, we felt there was a need to give even more emphasis to broaden the platform for GAO's foresight work. And creating the center was one of the steps in that direction. I've been building a foresight ecosystem at GAO for almost 10 years, and this was an important step in that direction. So back in fiscal year 2018, GAO's executive committee under the leadership of our Comptroller General, Gene Dodaro, approved a charter for the Center for Strategic Foresight. And the goal was to enhance our ability to analyze current and projected trends and their potential impact, not only on GAO as an agency, but also more broadly on federal agencies and the type of work that we're asked by Congress to do.
So, Steve, with such an interesting mission and portfolio, would you tell us more about your duties and responsibilities as director for GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight?
So I'm actually dual-hatted at GAO. I lead both the strategic foresight programs as the center director, and I also lead GAO's strategic planning. And GAO, I think, is a bit unique in that setup where we have both the strategic foresight and the strategic planning functions fused in the same office. And as we'll probably get into a little bit more in our discussion, that's got some real advantages where we're able to infuse foresight into our planning activities. But my main focus as center director is assuring that GAO is really looking into the future, thinking about potential future opportunities, potential risks, potential new areas and new ways of doing things that will help the agency ultimately deliver on its mission more effectively. But it's a great job. I think it's one of the best jobs in government. I've really enjoyed it. I've got great support from, as I mentioned, the our agency head, the Comptroller General, and also James Christian Blockwood, my managing director for strategic planning and external liaison. I've been huge supporters of Foresight at GAO, and that's been really terrific to have that kind of top level support.
You know, Steve, regarding your duties and responsibilities, what are the top challenges you face in your position, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Sure. So there's two that come to mind. So one challenge is if you survey people who do Foresight in government, typically you'll find that their shops are relatively small, and we're always thinking about how can we do more with limited resources. And that requires you to be creative, but especially, and this is, I think, the key here, is to build partnerships both across the agency and outside the agency. Foresight work is not something you can do locked away in a closet, not talking to anyone and not building alliances and partnerships across the agency. So a key to our success is really working well with other teams across GAO, partnering with them to understand what their needs are, how we can help them, and as well building partnerships outside the agency where we can to bolster our ability to do Foresight. That was also one of the reasons we created the Center for Strategic Foresight. It gave us a platform to work with experts in Foresight outside of our own agency. So we have, as non-resident fellows, part of the Center, experts in Foresight from around the world, from around the U.S. They come from academia, the private sector, from international organizations, and from government. And we're very lucky to be able to tap into that brain trust as we think about our Foresight mission at GAO. The second thing I will mention about how we, I think, have found some opportunities in the role, I've done a lot of work with building design thinking or human-centered design into our Foresight mission. And that has meant getting my team trained up on human-centered design techniques. I was fortunate enough to spend some time at Stanford University's design school, where I learned about design thinking. And kind of marrying those two things up has been really exciting and been, I think, very rewarding in terms of using the toolkit that Foresight provides to help think about the future and what the future can bring and identify some of those opportunities. And when you link that up with design thinking is really good at helping you create things in the present. And it's a really nice bridge for getting from the present into that future that you've been exploring through the Foresight tools. And I really like how that combination comes together. And we've done several projects around GAO where we've used those two different methodologies quite effectively.
So we go from your mission portfolio to the challenges you face. And I'd like to understand, Steve, what has surprised you most during your tenure at GAO?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably something most people are unprepared for is just the sheer breadth of work that takes place at GAO. The scope of GAO's mission is huge when you look at the fact we are charged with conducting analysis and research across essentially every domain of federal government operations. So whether that's education or healthcare or defense or banking and financial services, complex technology, you name it, we're there. And that is both wonderful and can also be a challenge when you're at the enterprise level thinking about how to develop strategies and prioritize, because that remit is so big. We serve and provide work for nearly every standing committee in the Congress. And so with that breadth of operational space, I think it creates a need to really think both tactically and also strategically about how best to cover all of those areas. I find that challenge a lot of fun. But it's definitely something surprising when you come to GAO, you see just how much we cover.
What is strategic foresight and how does it differ from futuristic forecasting? I'll ask Steve Sanford, director of GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.
To support government financial performance and accountability, financial systems must meet certain standards, and relying on outdated financial systems inhibits progress. ERP vendors are encouraging clients to move to the cloud and consider new technologies such as robotic process automation, blockchain, and AI to enhance financial productivity. Download the IBM Center Report, Financial Management for the Future, at businessofgovernment.org to learn why and how government can evolve to meet the demands of a digital world. The Ebola crisis in West Africa from 2014 to 2016 was an epidemic that put emphasis on global capacity to respond to international disasters. How can government better assess the needs of those affected and help them? The IBM Center Report, Responding to Global Health Crisis, by Professor Jennifer Widner, breaks down the U.S. response to the Ebola crisis and provides insights on lessons learned that may aid the government responses in the future. Download your free copy, Responding to Global Health Crisis, at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Steve Sanford, director of the Center for Strategic Foresight at the Government Accountability Office. Steve, what are the key strategic priorities for GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight? And more interestingly, how do these priorities connect with the emerging issues that were identified in GAO's strategic plan?
Sure. So maybe I'll start with the broader context of the strategic plan. Every 4 years, as most federal agencies do, GAO issues a strategic plan. And as I mentioned at the top, we put a lot of effort into mapping out the strategic context of what the broader landscape looks like as we put that plan together. And so in our last strategic plan, we had eight different macro trends we explored, everything from national security and the fiscal condition of the country to global cooperation and economics and trade, jobs and education. We looked at demographics, science and technology, how governance is evolving, and also environment and sustainability. And through that platform of trends, we were able to say, here are some of the broad drivers we see affecting the work we do and the things we can expect Congress to ask us to do over the next years that have really served to underpin the rest of the strategic plan's goals and objectives. Building off of that, we've been using the center to try to explore areas that maybe we didn't fully explore in the trends document from the strategic plan a number of years ago, or just issues that have evolved since then. For example, we talked about deep fakes and some challenges around those. We're really using the Center for Strategic Foresight to help focus GAO's attention, and by extension, Congress's attention on important emerging issues. So our main priorities right now are to explore areas that we feel need more attention and that are going to shape federal programs and potentially the work GAO does in the future more substantially, and also just the way GAO does work. So for example, one of the areas that the center is going to focus on this year is demographics. There are a lot of demographic drivers changing how federal programs will be managed in the coming years, and they also have potentially big effects on the federal budget. So we see that the country has an aging population. Birth rates in general are down. That means we're going to have more people retiring with fewer workers to support them. That's going to pose significant financial challenges to the country. And there are other drivers that are happening on demographics in terms of rural and urban divides and where people are living, and as well just how our country looks and who is going to be in the current youth bubble that we see coming of different diverse groups. So there's a lot going on with demographics that I think is important to understand. Another project we're working on is how the whole notion of accountability, I mean, that's in our name at GAO. What does that look like in the future? So we're going to spend some time this year at the center also exploring changing ideas about how auditors can do their work. What does that look like in the future? How would an audit agency or accountability agency function in the future? What kinds of things does it need to think about in terms of skills, tools, and resources?
And as I mentioned earlier, GAO publishes a strategic plan every 4 years that emphasizes consideration of future issues that may affect the federal government and society as a whole. Can you tell us more and elaborate more on your role in developing and shaping GAO's strategic plan? What are the trends identified in the plan? And perhaps you could tell us more about the planning process for developing the document.
Sure. So I think it's the process is one of the things I'm proudest of. We do the plan completely in-house at GAO. So we don't outsource it to consultants or anything like that. We really rely on the subject matter expertise of the people we have at GAO who cover all those different issue areas I mentioned. You know, we have 15 different teams at GAO with subject matter expertise. That's a huge resource for us. And it's really as much their plan as anyone's. And we look to using that expertise, leveraging that expertise to help shape out some of these trends. So one of the starting points we do is my team is engaged in a process of what we call horizon scanning or environmental scanning, where we're constantly looking for emerging issues that could inform the trends in the plan. And then we kind of take our knowledge from that effort, and we link that up to interviews we do with our internal subject matter experts. So we'll ask them, what is Congress asking you about? What do you see as an important risk or opportunity in the future? What are some of the blind spots maybe people aren't thinking about? And so we bring those two things together, the work we've done in our foresight shot along with the subject matter expertise. And from there, we kind of map out what our trends are going to look like. And then we work with the teams to write them in-house. And this does a couple of things. First, it creates buy-in. The teams have a sense of ownership of the plan. The second thing is the teams themselves, we have then parts of the agency going through the process of thinking about the future as they help develop the trends. And I think that's really important. The extent to which a planning process can really get everybody on board into thinking about the future, the more that can happen, the better. And I think when we pull our trends together at GAO, we really do move the ball down the field and trying to achieve that goal.
So, we talked about the mission of the Center for Strategic Foresight, your priorities, your other responsibilities at GAO, but we've never defined in all this conversation, what is strategic foresight? Could you tell us what strategic foresight is? And more interestingly, how does it differ from futuristic forecasting? And how can strategic foresight help government leaders be more effective?
Sure. That's a great question. And I think it's one of the biggest misconceptions about strategic foresight is that it tries to predict the future or tries to forecast things. Forecasting and foresight are related, but they are quite different. Forecasting is essentially working from existing data. A lot of times it's just time series data and projecting that out into the future, right? We have a certain set of assumptions, baseline data, maybe some constraints. And you get some smart statisticians or economists or actuaries, and they draw the line, and they can tell you what that forecast is going to look like and maybe what some of the error bars are around it. But it's a prediction, and that's not what strategic foresight is about. Strategic foresight is really a tool to bring in when you don't know what that dotted line is going to be, or you don't have a good sense of it. You know, so an analogy might be forecasting. We're all familiar with weather forecasting, and we get our predictions for what the weather looks like over the next several days where we live. But a strategic foresight approach would ask those what if questions. You know, what if we had a sustained drought? What if there were 3 weeks of sustained blizzards? It asks those kinds of questions, which lead you down very different paths. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. So it's really where we don't have data, or we're asking questions where the forecasts are leaving off, that foresight comes to really shine. And I think there's a couple of ways that foresight can help leaders be more effective. The first, when you go through a foresight exercise, especially with executives, one of the first things you do is you start challenging assumptions. Everybody goes into their work every day with a sort of set of baseline assumptions. And if you think about it, that's actually the complete opposite of forecasting, right? Forecasting, we're taking our baseline assumptions and we're trying to project into the future. Strategic foresight is saying, let's actually have a real tough conversation about those baseline assumptions. Are those even the right assumptions? Can we change them? Is there space to do that? And then that takes you down a very different path. And that's just a major change in mindset that I think is really essential for leaders to be more effective. The second thing foresight can do is, because it's interdisciplinary and it really values seeing how larger systems, especially complex systems, work, it emphasizes breaking down silos or breaking down barriers between organizational entities within an agency. And that's another, I think, vital aspect to strategic foresight, that it helps facilitate conversations across boundaries and find those places where maybe an issue doesn't have a clear owner, or maybe a risk has the potential to fall through a crack. And that's another way that foresight can really be important for leaders.
And you've said this, Steve, you know, strategic foresight isn't new in the government, but can you tell us about some of the ways foresight has been used and applied in the operations of government?
Sure. I think one of the places folks might be most familiar with foresight work is the National Intelligence Council. Does its global trends work that was led for a number of years by Matthew Burroughs. And I know that they're working on their next iteration of that document. And typically, you will talk to a lot of people in the defense and intelligence communities who have engaged in foresight through the years. And that makes sense, right? They're looking at long-range scenario plans. They need to think the unthinkable and go down those paths. So you'll find in a lot of the national security areas and different components of DOD, and even now to some extent DHS, people thinking about this. But it's not limited there. There's a very active community across the federal government. My boss, James Christian Blockley, he founded this group, the Federal Foresight Community of Interest, and a member of my team now has taken up the reins of being a co-chair there, Cheryl Grisiak. And you know, through her leadership and the people she works with in that group, that's really helped create a community across government where folks can find allies and like-minded practitioners and discuss both the challenges and the success stories that come from practicing foresight in government. So it's definitely an active area. We're very fortunate at GAO, where with the stability of the way we're set up, so the Comptroller General, the head of our agency, has a 15-year term, and something like foresight can really blossom and grow over that 15-year term. And we've also had a series of Comptrollers General who have supported it. So foresight has been able to put down deep roots here at GAO. When you just look across other agencies and the natural rhythm of administrations changing and senior executives changing and political appointees changing, that steady state isn't always there for foresight. And so you'll notice a variability across agencies, sort of as to how well it's rooted or whether it's been there for a long time. And I think that's one challenge the community has, but there are a lot of people really committed to it. And it's good to see, not only in this country, but also globally, there's a very active community in government trying to get out of the day-to-day kind of tactical decisions and think more long-term for the agencies.
Strategic foresight can inform national policy in the face of profound uncertainty about what lies ahead. And you know, I was wondering, what is the best way to link foresight to decision-making?
So one of the essential components of, I think, making foresight operationalized and kind of bringing it to life is linking it to core business processes within an organization. So if there is a foresight team and really all they're doing is occasionally creating a research paper and they're kind of hived off doing their thing, but aren't linked up and integrated into the key business processes of the agency, then they're not going to be as effective as a unit. So I mentioned earlier, foresight at GAO, we are linked very closely with the strategic planning process. We are also linked to processes that look at annual tactical planning. We are also linked very closely to reviews looking at enterprise risk. We do a lot of hands-on work helping teams across GAO think about how they can maybe change how they approach their work or their planned work in the future. So we have those very concrete touch points with established business processes and that are also keyed into the core work, the core mission of the agency. So I think to be successful, the foresight ecosystem has to work across all those key components of an agency in order to have meaningful impact. Otherwise, it's going to be something that is just on the side and is not necessarily influencing or providing information to help inform decision-making.
Steve, to what extent is cross-agency collaboration essential for effective strategic foresight? And how can existing efforts be improved to achieve this goal?
Sure. So first of all, I would you know, recommend everyone review what's in OMB A11. So sections 220 and 230 actually lay out very coherently how strategic planning and how cross-cutting agency priority goals interact with each other. And I think that's an important starting point, is to just have some knowledge of the fundamentals of what's there. I would defer to my colleague Chris Mim, who I know you've had on the show before, and his team on how well that's happening across agencies and in OMB through the annual processes. But there was a vision set out in the GIPR Modernization Act that governs all of this that really did call for priority goals to be set across agencies. And I think to have an effective strategic planning effort, and A11 talks about this, there needs to be some consideration of how those government-wide priority goals will fit into individual agencies' planning. So that's, I think, a really important thing to keep in mind. And just as part of any agency's scanning, they should think about to what extent does their stakeholder map include other agencies, or what are their touch points with other agencies, whether that's potential for data sharing or other types of support. Or GAO has done a lot of work on overlap and duplication, and that would be another place to look in terms of how to better align goals across agencies. So it's definitely worth doing, and should be a part of the strategic planning process.
Whether it's the Evidence Act or what have you, the demand for measurable outcomes has posed an enduring challenge in the public sector, but also in the private sector as well. Steve, can the effectiveness of strategic foresight be measured?
Yeah, this is a huge question, actually, in the community of practitioners of foresight. It's how do you measure this thing? And if you think about it, it is a big challenge. You have something at a high level that's agency-wide, and you know ultimately you would want everything you're doing through a foresight and strategic planning effort to be supporting the overall goals and missions of the agency and whatever ways you've got set up to measure that. But that still doesn't always satisfy everybody when they think about this question. And it may be one where you know, we have to rethink the metrics a bit. And considering an analogy outside of government might be helpful when contemplating this. So you know, if we pretend that we are, you know, we rewind a couple of decades, we're flip phone manufacturers, you know, making the old school flip phones, we might have a really robust set of metrics that measure market penetration for these phones, and we're measuring defect rates as they come off the assembly line, and customer satisfaction, right? So we have this really robust set of metrics, and we think we're doing fine. But we have no clue with those metrics that there might be a huge strategic shift with the advent of smartphones or touchscreens that are going to render the flip phone obsolete. So how do you measure that, right? It's really hard on a kind of quarterly or annual cadence with the metrics that would really give you a good sense of, is your business running well or not, or is your agency delivering on its goals? You know, how do you link that to these broader strategic questions? I'm not sure it can be. And it actually, I think, points to the need to have a regular and structured foresight process, especially linked up with strategic planning, where that is considered, where those sorts of things that aren't captured by your metrics can be on the table and can be thought about, those what-if scenarios. And that might be one way to think of it. Another would be to consider, what are the indicators of an effective foresight program? And this kind of builds a little bit on what I was talking about before, but you could imagine a set of indicators such as executive leadership buy-in, starting with the head of the agency. You could measure that. You can look at things like what are the touch points with the key business processes or key operational mission-related processes across the agency as another potential metric. What's the visibility or awareness of the program? So there are some things that I think one could start to look at in terms of getting some indicators as to the success or robustness of a program. But I think, back to your original question, Michael, it's going to be tricky to assess, I think, with the kind of classic set of metrics that we use when we think about performance, to evaluate fully what foresight does, because it is at that strategic kind of what-if level.
What is the cross-sectoral impact of COVID-19? I will ask Steve Sanford, director of GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.
How does an agency decide upon and implement a performance management framework that will be successful for their specific administration? The IBM Center Report, A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results, follows the implementation and results of the CSTAT Management Framework in Colorado's Department of Homeland Security in hopes that it can guide others who may want to institute a similar approach. Download A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results by Melissa Wavelet on businessofgovernment.org today. Agile methodology has allowed for agencies to keep up with the growing demands for fast response to problem solving. The Opportunity Project, TOP, serves as a catalyst in adapting agile techniques to solve complex agency mission problems. TOP works with federal agencies to identify challenges and facilitate iterative approaches in response. In the IBM Center report, Agile Problem Solving in Government, Joel Gurin and Katerina Ribello discuss the factors of success involved in TOP. Download your free copy today at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Steve Sanford, director of the Center for Strategic Foresight at the Government Accountability Office. Steve, we are conducting this discussion virtually as we remain in the midst of a pandemic. I was wondering, what can you tell us about the cross-sectoral impact of COVID-19 beyond the obvious health and economic aspects?
So one of the things I did with my team and the Center for Strategic Foresight at the end of March, beginning of April, in the throes of the first lockdown, was to do some work asking that question and exploring what some of the implications are and delivering that as a product to our internal management teams. Everyone was running fire drills in terms of just how do we work remotely? How do we meet the needs of Congress? Even the mundane things of, you know, we have travel planned, how do we cancel it? Things like that. So everyone was in fire drill mode. We thought it was an important moment in our Foresight shop to take a strategic pause and think about what are some of the spillover effects of COVID in those areas, as you said, that extended beyond health and the unemployment issues. And some of those insights fell into some broad categories. For example, just questions around global security and national security. What does this mean moving forward? How destabilizing will this be as we navigate through? And I should start by saying also, Michael, that what really underscores all of this is just the massive amount of uncertainty involved, right? We are in a point right now where there seems to be easing. If you look at the numbers in terms of infection, there's a lot of questions as to, will that trend line continue? Are we going to see a second wave? A lot of uncertainty. And that uncertainty, I think, informs all of these areas. So there's great uncertainty on how this will play out over the next 6 months, over the next 12 months, over the next 18 months in countries around the world. We've seen extremely differential impacts in countries. And in some countries, it's hard to get information. That's potentially destabilizing, and I think is something for us to be aware of. The second was, you know, back in April and late March, it was apparent there were some disparities in how COVID was affecting different communities in the U.S. There's going to be a very big debate that plays out over the next year and beyond on where are we going with global integration. We were sort of at the peak in some ways of global integration before COVID hit. I mean, people were traveling all over the world in unprecedented numbers. Global trade was robust. There are going to be countries or going to be governments that start to question their supply chains, that are going to question what are the national security implications of reliance on imports. There are going to be a lot of discussions like that had. And some of the things that we may have taken for granted in terms of global supply chains and which have actually, you know, reduced the cost of a lot of goods in recent decades, some of those may be on the table for consideration. And not only in this country, but in others. Well, I'll end with two other points. One is, and this is, you know, near and dear to GAO's heart, just what are the impacts going to be on government finances? There was extraordinary measures taken to respond with financial support to the COVID crisis. How that plays out, states and localities are experiencing severe decreases in their tax base from the shutdowns and so forth. There's going to be a serious budgetary challenge confronting a lot of state and local governments in the coming year and beyond. That's going to have profound implications on services that are provided at that level of government, and also raise additional questions about how the federal government interacts with state and local governments. And then finally, I think we also saw through the crisis how a lot of organizations innovated very quickly in terms of either bringing different types of technology online, finding ways to work remotely when they hadn't been able to do that before. I think there's a big question as to whether that innovation mindset will continue post-COVID or is just a flash in the pan. And I think that's a question a lot of agencies and organizations are wrestling with in terms of what this COVID year has meant in terms of long-term impact on agencies and organizations.
So Steve, as a follow-up, are there efforts around building resiliency into various aspects of government operations? And what can be done to make various ecosystems more resilient? And I know GAO has come up with a disaster resilience framework. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that and how that factors into this kind of question.
Sure. It's a great question. And you're spot on, Michael. We're seeing through the COVID lens, and we also saw in the years running up to this through disaster, natural disaster lenses, the importance of this concept around resilience and what can the government do to help build resilience in our systems. So a number of years ago, I got started in a project at GAO where we were asking this question around disaster resilience. And it's an example, actually, of where my office brought together some design thinking and foresight tools to help bring a really diverse group of experts to the table from around GAO to think about what are the elements that would factor into natural disaster resilience. What are the types of communities? What are the stakeholders that would be involved in framing that out? And that led to the disaster resilience framework, I think you mentioned, was issued in October of 2019. That work was led by GAO's Director for Homeland Security and Justice, Chris Curry. But with the support of a really broad range of experts across GAO, because disaster resilience, it not only cuts across levels of government, but it also cuts across sectors, everything from what governs building codes to first responders and how, for example, FEMA interacts with state and local government. So that whole ecosystem had to be considered in the development of the framework. And what I really liked about the framework is, in some ways, what it lays out, I think, is applicable for any number of approaches to resilience, because the framework talks about having vision. It talks about needing to understand the stakeholders, and it's based on having a good sense of who the stakeholders are, and also looks at incentives. And it's also very interdisciplinary. And I think any kind of conversation about resilience has to start with those things. Resiliency ecosystems are very complex. They have a wide range of stakeholders. So some of the same tools that can be used in foresight and design thinking can actually help organizations explore what it means to be resilient by doing that stakeholder mapping, by doing the needs assessment, by asking those kind of creative what if questions or how might we questions about designing a future that we would prefer to have than what we do now. Because ultimately, that's what resiliency is about. It's not avoiding future events, but it's about mapping out how we would wish to encounter them and find ourselves on the other side of them. And I think that's an important distinction.
So, Steve, I know you had a role in facilitating the development of GAO's science and technology plan. And I know there's some key S&T issues that were identified, and GAO also reorganized how it works. I'd love you to talk about that a little bit, but also focus a little bit more on artificial intelligence, AI, and how important it's becoming in our digitized life. At the same time, there's so many promises, there are a lot of perils and risks. How has GAO sought to gain a better understanding of the emerging opportunities, challenges, and implications resulting from the development in AI? And perhaps you can highlight some of the challenges and implications.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. This has been a huge area of focus for GAO. We talked about the importance of artificial intelligence in our strategic plan trends and in our last strategic plan we put together. We saw it as a key emerging issue that was going to have not only a major impact on how government is done, but just in everybody's daily lives, and that certainly there would be interest from the Congress on it. As we're partnered with a lot of teams across GAO, we've been working closely with GAO's new science, technology, and analytics team. Back in 2018, we partnered with them to issue GAO's first technology assessment on artificial intelligence. And that laid the groundwork for some subsequent work I can mention in a moment. But there's also been a lot of other work across GAO looking at the effects of AI and automation. Not only being done within the science and technology team, but in others. So GAO has looked at the effects of workforce automation, It's examined automated vehicle policy. It's looked at how technology is influencing or having implications on the federal workforce and talent management. We've also looked at facial recognition technology. So there's a wide scope of different issues related to AI that cut across different issue areas. But really, you know, specifically on the S&T parts of it, GAO has done work looking at not only overall assessing technology, but how it's being applied in different domains. So our 2018 work, we really focused on what were some of the learnings we could apply from looking at the way AI is used in some what we call high consequence activities, things like cybersecurity, things like automated vehicles, things like the criminal justice system or financial services. These are all places where if AI doesn't work right, it could have profound implications. So we thought by examining that and bringing a forum of experts together under the Comptroller General's convening power, we could explore some of those insights. And we uncovered some areas for policy consideration in terms of where, for example, safety and security need to be taken into account, or incentives for data sharing need to be bolstered, but also looking at areas of research such as computational ethics and explainable AI, or how can better quality labeled data be derived, things like that. Also the potential importance of sandboxes, where different regulatory regimes for monitoring or providing oversight over AI can be tested. So we had a number of insights come out of that work. Another area we've at GAO been exploring with regard to AI has been in healthcare. So we issued our first report on machine learning and drug development at the end of 2019. And there's another report underway right now looking at how artificial intelligence is being used in the delivery of medical services. So this is an area that's got a lot of interest from the Congress, and one that GAO has put a number of resources into. The science and technology team you mentioned that was created back in January of 2019, that team's been growing, and I think that reflects Congress's investment in that capability at GAO reflects the bipartisan support that GAO has in terms of wanting nonpartisan and independent analysis of S&T issues.
So, Steve, in 2019, the Center for Strategic Foresight at GAO convened a conference to discuss policy challenges related to two issues, deepfakes and the evolving trends in space. Would you tell us more about these emerging issues? What are deepfakes? And what insights came out of that conference?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. We were really excited about that conference. It was a chance to really, as one of the inaugural public events that the center was doing, explore two issues that we had been tracking in the center and also with my Foresight team for a while. One of them around deepfakes, which I'll talk about in a minute, and then also a lot of really neat things happening in space. And 2019 saw the advent of three different countries trying to land vehicles on the moon. None of them were Russia or the U.S. So that the whole landscape of who's doing what in space had changed. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the governance structures that apply to space, right? Who owns something on the moon? What happens when private actors start doing stuff on the moon? Some of the treaty regimes we have in place, we heard from experts, never contemplated the idea that you could have private sector actors doing stuff in space to the extent they are. And this was a fascinating area to explore. We're also, we're far more reliant on satellites than ever before. And space is big and vast, but it's also in some ways getting crowded. I've got a member of my team right now working on some research into space debris, which was one of the things that came out of that conference. This idea that there's a huge risk from everything from crude space exploration and operations to just getting stuff into orbit or even out of orbit for deeper space exploration, of running into other objects. There's a lot of space junk in orbit that could be catastrophic if something is hit. And it's a cascading effect. This is the other interesting thing that came out of the conversation. If you have one or two disasters in terms of colliding stuff in space, you're creating more and more debris, which is going to create more and more risk of further such collisions. So there's a kind of major opportunity that's happening right now in space. And we've seen that with the public-private sector collaborations that took place this year with getting a crewed launch. But there's also a number of things that need to be worked out. So that was the first step in exploring some of those space issues. Deep fakes was also an issue we were tracking quite closely. Artificial intelligence, I mean, coming back to artificial intelligence, that technology has evolved in a way where there are many algorithms that can generate things that only previously humans could generate, right? Whether that's text or human voice, whether that's an image or a video. AI algorithms and systems are able to synthesize these things. And that creates the potential for what happens when fake media is injected into platforms that we all use every day in our lives. So social media's influence and prevalence in people's lives is nothing new. And to the extent that misinformation campaigns or deepfakes might be used in those platforms is a big consideration, something that's been of interest to Congress. We briefed a couple of committees on the Hill after that work. And then we also partnered with the science and technology team we mentioned and talked about earlier. They issued a technology spotlight on deepfakes as well. So that spun out of our conference. So it's really about highlighting issues that either maybe aren't getting as much attention as they should from a broader audience, such as the space policy issues that we explored, or highlighting and casting extra attention onto things that have the potential to be disruptive, like deep fakes. But it's interesting. Deep fakes is getting to the point where we see a kind of cat and mouse game evolving, where algorithms are getting good at creating it, but then forensic algorithms are getting good at detecting it. And so there's this almost arms race of which is going to be better. And a lot of what we talked about in the conference too was around the need for education. You know, this idea of digital literacy and for users of social media platforms to understand that these risks exist, and that there can also be industry solutions to help address some of this, such as watermarking and things like that are being explored.
So, Steve, what is being done to develop, enhance, and strengthen the strategic foresight capacity in the U.S. government?
Sure. So there's certainly, no shortage of examples around the world of, prominent foresight offices and different national governments. Canada has one. Singapore is very robust with its foresight program. Finland has a foresight office attached to its parliament. Our form of government, the way we budget, the way we have the three branches separate and independent the way they are, we're not in a parliamentary system, for example, where you actually do see a lot of foresight offices attached to and sort of leveraging a parliamentary system around the world. I think we have to acknowledge we just as a government are set up differently. And locating a home for foresight, a sort of unified view of foresight across the U.S. federal government is hard because there is no such thing across all three branches of the U.S. federal government. Now, I think at GAO, actually, we are probably the closest thing that we have to a national foresight office. We have the ear of Congress, as I mentioned at the top. We cover this enormous breadth of issues, and that remit gives us the scope to actually assist Congress on issues of greatest national importance and to explore emerging issues across all those different domains. So I think GAO, and especially with our nonpartisan and independent values, is well positioned to serve that role for Congress. And I think you know, looking at ways to maybe deepen the expertise and the application of foresight across agencies would also help to kind of create that more government-wide capability.
Well, Steve, thanks very much. I want to ask you one final question, and that is, what advice would you give someone who's considering a career in public service?
Sure. So I would say, you know, bring your innovation mindset into government and don't be afraid to try to use it. I have greatly benefited in my team having new and fresh perspectives. And I'm not talking about just hiring entry-level people either. It's people with different backgrounds who come from different industries. And having that kind of perspective in your foresight team is really important. But I think just public sector and public service in general benefits from a wide diversity of experiences that people may have had. And it's interesting, Michael, I've just in the last couple of months gotten a little bit into woodworking, and anyone who does woodworking knows that you've got to keep your chisels sharpened. And I think a lot of us come into public service with really sharp chisels, and when you use a chisel, it dulls. And do we take the time to resharpen our chisels? And I think bringing folks in with new and different and fresh perspectives is one way to do that. But my advice to someone who's considering public service is bring your sharp chisel into government and keep it sharp. Don't let it get dulled from using it. And I think sometimes we fall into that trap in public service of we might have a lot of fresh energy and momentum in what we're doing, and those sharp blades get a little bit dulled over time. And keeping it fresh, using things like foresight actually to constantly question assumptions and get different views, get out of the four walls of our own agencies and see our agencies from the perspective of others. Having that type of much more holistic approach, I think, is something that public service would benefit from. And I think there's ample opportunity for folks to bring that kind of energy and innovation mindset into government, and I hope they do so.
So, Steve, I want to thank you for joining me today and taking time out of your busy schedule. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure. It's a privilege to work at GAO. We've got 3,000 plus fantastic people working there, all aligned on a great mission to help government work better. So it's a privilege to be a part of it, and I'm glad to talk to you about it today.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Steve Sanford, director of GAO's Center for Strategic Foresight. Be sure to join me next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government leadership and its effectiveness. Until then, subscribe, download, and listen to the entire interview at Podcast One, iTunes, or on your favorite podcast app, and as always at businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How can government best use big data to transform decision-making, public services delivery, and communication? The IBM Center Report, Integrating Big Data and Thick Data to Transform Public Services Delivery, by Yan-Yan Ang, presents 5 recommendations for public managers introducing the concept of mixed analytics, urging thick data, meaning qualitative information about users, to be presented alongside big data to improve government decision-making. Visit businessofgovernment.org to read more.